Mr. Cobb?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you, and Mr. McGaugh, good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Thank you, Mr. Cobb, then you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. McGaugh. My name is Gage Cobb. I'm a deputy Sarpy County attorney appearing on behalf of the state in regard to this error proceedings that the state has filed in regards to the jury instructions that were submitted for trial in this case regarding self-defense. Now I'm going to start by out with addressing the issue that the court asked us to be prepared for at oral argument regarding whether or not this error proceedings application is a situation that would allow for an authoritative exposition of the law. And I think it does. I think this situation would for a couple reasons. The issue of self-defense in criminal cases, oftentimes from when I read the case law, is somewhat confusing, but it also can contain principles that this court has set forth that are seemingly in conflict with each other at certain times. And I think part of that is because there is a factual underpinning when you're dealing with a self-defense argument. We know the principles that the court is required to instruct on self-defense if there is any evidence of a legally cognizable theory. This court has also set forth principles that it is to instruct on the defendant's theory of the case if the defendant presents sufficient evidence. My review of the case law, I don't see a single case on self-defense that contains both of these unique issues in regards to whether or not the defendant was the primary initial aggressor and whether or not the defendant's actions were intentional or voluntary. This is a unique situation that I think this court would be able to address based off those facts that would help provide some authoritative exposition of the law for future cases.
Just to make sure I understand, you're saying you have not found a case in which both the argument that the defendant was the initial aggressor, or excuse me, the victim was the... the initial aggressor and the involuntary issue are presented together. You
yes.
say you haven't found a case. Why would that matter that they're both presented?
Well, I think it matters for this. I think oftentimes courts, nobody wants to give wrong jury instructions, and the court never wants to take a factual issue away from the jury. However, in the case of self-defense, there's a initial factual determination that a court makes. I would say it's really a matter of law. It's a legal decision, but it's based off the sufficiency of that evidence. And so I think the courts oftentimes err on the side of, hey, it looks like we have competing facts here, so I'm going to give the instruction, when really their duty is, no, you have to examine those facts initially and determine if there's slight evidence of a legally cognizable theory, and then you have to instruct if that's the case. Here, the evidence in this case, because there was evidence of a primary aggressor that wasn't in controversy by the defendant's own admissions, at that point, I think the district court was required to say, hey, the evidence shows that you're the primary aggressor. You're not entitled to a self-defense instructions, regardless if, and I don't agree that there is a factual dispute, but I think the district court's focus on was whether or not the defendant's actions were intentional or voluntary. That only comes into play after he was the primary initial aggressor. So I think that unique set of facts indicates that this would be a helpful exposition of law for the court to address and examine.
What's the case going to stand for? What will Valadez someday be cited for that you hope?
Sure. I hope that Valadez will be cited for that when a court seemingly has a situation where there could be facts that one might argue are in conflict that should go to the jury, the court still has to examine all of the facts and first make a determination whether there's a legally cognizable theory. Here, the district court didn't address the primary aggressor. The district court went straight to Valadez, said he pushed in one incident, and Valadez says it was not intentional, it was involuntary in the next. And I think the district court felt, because from this court's case law, if there's potentially a question of fact, or if there's seemingly slight evidence, that it has to give that to the jury. I think this case can stand for the proposition, no, you have to look at all of the evidence in support or being offered.
So your argument is that this court would set a rule that in self-defense cases, the judge has to make some initial determination on the facts, which would become a question of law as to whether or not the defendant was the initial aggressor. Is that right?
No, I think whether or not, I think the judge has to look at the facts and make an initial question determination, which I would characterize as a question of law, based off the
facts. It's a factual determination that you would call a question of law.
And this is the unique part, and this is where I think it gets confusing for judges. Even as recently as the Bedford case in the Court of Appeals, you have some very fine judges in the Court of Appeals who disagreed whether or not there was the accident portion applied or whether or not there was a reasonable good faith and justification for the self-defense. It's not unlike, say, a contract. A contract, a court is required to first make a determination whether there's an ambiguity. The court has to look at that contract and look at those terms, and that's a question of law for the court to decide whether there's an ambiguity. And then if there's an ambiguity, it's for the jury to decide factually what that meaning is. It's much, I think, the same here. The court gets an initial set of evidence that's presented, and the court has to decide as a matter of law, is there enough evidence that I should instruct on self-defense?
Isn't that every case? I mean, isn't that what judges do?
It is what they do in every case. This case presented a unique set of circumstances that I don't think are never going to occur again. They have the ability to occur again, in which you somewhat have competing principles of, here's the defendant's theory. The defendant never advanced these other theories. His theory was never that he did it, and it was in self-defense. It was always that it was unintentional, it was accidental, it was a fight or flight. The defendant's uncontroverted evidence was that he came out, he initiated this, he could have stayed in his house, he didn't have to come out.
So we have cases that say if the defendant is the initial aggressor, you don't get a self-defense instruction, correct?
Correct.
We have cases that say if the defendant testifies that he was acting unintentionally or involuntarily, you don't get a self-defense instruction.
Correct.
Why do we need another one if we agree with you?
We don't have a case where we have both. And I think that makes this case unique. I think the district court felt that if there was seemingly a question of fact for the jury to decide, or that there was enough evidence to submit on the intentional unintentional aspect, that he had to do that, and disregarded the fact that the evidence showed that he was the primary aggressor. Therefore, you don't even get to that. So this is the first case I've seen where we kind of have these two areas where you have to decide whether you get self-defense. You may not get self-defense if you're the primary aggressor. You may not get self-defense if you're if your actions were unintentional. This combines both of them, and I think what this court could say is, when you have both, you still got to examine both. You don't get to look at it and say, hey, there might be a question of fact here or enough evidence for a jury to decide on the intentional and unintentional. You still have to make the decision on the other. I get implicitly that the court made that decision when it decided to give the instruction, but I think this would provide for just some explanation, given that we have these two unique circumstances combined into this one case.
You agree that no matter what we might say, the acquittal is going to stand?
Absolutely. And that's part of what I think would be beneficial, too. I'll be honest. I think as a trial attorney, I think any time this court gives information and guidance on jury instructions, arguably one of the trial judge's most important job is jury instructions, I think it's helpful in any case and to any practitioner. I do agree and don't dispute that the acquittal is going to stand, and I'm not here to reverse that. I respect the jury's decision in that regard. I think it's, as I indicated, and I think you can see in the transcript, in the Bill of Exceptions, I in my argument to the court about the importance of getting it right the first time, was just this. If we don't get it right the first time, and the defendant is convicted, on appeal, this court would say it wasn't right, and it would reverse, and the defendant would have the chance to be retried. In the case where the court doesn't get it right, and the defendant's acquitted, the state has no recourse but this. And I think the system requires that everybody try to get it right. I know everybody tried to. And because you have a situation where you have something of this importance and an acquittal, and if this court were to say we're wrong, there's nothing that can be done, is that justice too? You know? And so that's the basis in which we brought the appeal, is because we think that this can provide an authoritative exposition of the law on these issues that would be helpful in making sure that the parties and the judges get it right going forward. And with that, I'm out of time. If there's no other questions, I'd ask that this court sustain the exception. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McGaw, good morning to you again.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Other members of the court, Jim McGaw on behalf of Mr. Valadez. May it please counsel. To address the issue requested by this court as set forth in the Larkins case, whether or not there is any authoritative exposition needed, I think it's significant of what my friend on the other side says, is that this is a unique case, situation unlikely to occur again, or at least occur very often. So from that standpoint, there's really no pressing need for this court to issue any kind of authoritative exposition in regards to the issues that are present here.
Well, only to make sure that we've all discussed this and discarded it, you're in agreement that defendant was placed in jeopardy.
So, yes. Thank you. Yes, Your Honor. No question about that. Witness was called. Verdict was reached. The instructions, ultimately, if the court does move beyond the Larkins decision or other similar cases and make a determination on the merits, I think it's clear that the judge engaged in a very thoughtful conversation with counsel and made a determination pursuant to the Kinzer case that there was some justification for the self-defense argument or instruction, and it wasn't the court's responsibility, excuse me, as set forth in Kinzer and as set forth in Bedford. It wasn't the court's determination to determine how strong or how, it was the court's determination to determine how plausible, but not to determine the strengths of that argument or to make a factual determination of intentional versus unintentional.
Was there any theory forwarded by the defendant at trial that he intentionally used deadly force against the alleged victim? Yeah, so can you direct me to it?
Sure. As question, Your Honor, no. Here's what I would say about that. The defendant's position is that the harm was unintentional, but the act was intentional. So when you ask about, was there any evidence to show that the use of deadly force was intentional, I would say no, and I would say it's very, very similar to the Bedford case. Husband pushes wife off of him, she falls down and gets injured, and in that case he says the push was intentional, but the harm that resulted from that push was not intentional, and the Court of Appeals in that case just recently said the instruction was appropriate to give. Same thing here. He says the push was intentional because I didn't know what the guy was going to do. It looked like he was reaching for something, and I pushed off of him. But the harm, that was not intentional.
Well, he also has this testimony, though, that he's asked, are you saying it was much like if I hit my funny bone and my arm moves? That to me doesn't sound like an intentional push. That sounds like reflex.
I understand. And that... there, clearly, with the way that he testified on direct examination versus some of those ways that he answered those questions on cross-examination do demonstrate a difference of facts which is to be determined by the jury ultimately. But there were, here's the question. Are there facts sufficient to justify the instruction? And the answer is yes. And that it's up to the jury to decide, hey, there's differences here in some of the answers, there's differences here in some of the facts. Maybe even there's some facts that make the defense contradictory to itself. But those are factual determinations to be made by the finder of fact. And what my friend on the other side's proposition here is for this court to adopt a rule that would require the court to step in the place of the fact finder and make those kind of preliminary determinations when the body of cases on these kind of on the self-destruction self-defense instruction, when the body of law of those cases indicate that that's not the court's responsibility. It's the court's responsibility to determine, is there evidence that would justify the instruction? And if so, let the jury decide.
Would it be more accurate or even a little bit accurate? That's a bad choice. To say there may have been competing theories,
yes.
One of which would support a self-defense instruction and another theory that would not support it.
I think that's correct.
And then what is a trial judge to do?
Trial judge is to let the jury sort that out. And I think the instruction from the Kinzer case and frankly every case this decided the self-defense argument or self-defense instruction is if there's any evidence to support it, give it and let the jury decide if the force is justifiable or not. And that's what happened here. We disagree with my friend's assertions that the defendant here was the initial aggressor. I think if you look at those cases that describe the initial aggressor, the Eagle Thunder case, the Marshall case, those are cases where the victims in the case aren't engaged in any kind of criminal activity or any kind of wrongdoing. And here, the situation is completely different. The crime is ongoing at the time that the defendant responds to it.
Was it a crime of aggression? Were they robbing or were they?
I don't know that the defendant knew that. I think that what the defendant knew at that time was there were individuals that were not authorized to be in vehicles that appeared to be getting into vehicles. And whether that was a crime of aggression or not, I don't know that we can really say that. I think does he have reason to believe that either a felony theft was occurring or some other felony was occurring? I think he did, and I think a jury ultimately determined that that was right. But to parse it out of does it need to be a crime of aggression or not, that I don't know. I think that at the time that the defendant responded and his actions that were preventative in nature at the time that he exercised those actions, self-protective, he didn't know what those individuals were doing, pushed off, I think that was reasonable. And
isn't the question about who was an initial aggressor something for a jury?
I think so, and it was argued. Both sides argued it. So I think it is an issue for the jury. I think that when my friend is relying upon cases that suggest that if you're the initial aggressor, then you don't get the instruction, I think that his reliance on those cases for that argument is misplaced in this situation.
Do you understand your opponent to be arguing that there was something wrong with the language of the instruction, or simply it shouldn't have been given at all?
My understanding is the latter, not the former. It's my understanding that he's saying it shouldn't have been given at all because he's also objecting to instruction 4, which is the elements that is set, that requires unless by self-defense. So it's my understanding that he's arguing it shouldn't have been given at all.
That's all I have, unless there's any other questions from the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. Counsel, you are excused. In State versus Valadez. The next case of the day is State versus Bond.